On March 20th and 21st at the Nimoy.
Feel it in my chest.
Bello tells the extraordinary true story of one of Ireland's foremost accordionists, Danny O'Mahony, a man who has dedicated his life to the preservation of traditional Irish music and to the mastery of his craft. Tickets and further information is available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
It shines with that. It settles that.
Hi, this is V Neal, and you are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, California.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage.
I'm Lisa Detmer. Today I wanted to get an Iranian feminist perspective on the war against Iran. To do that, we have three Iranian and Iranian-American scholars and activists to help us better understand what a feminist response to this war would be. We talked to Iranian graduate student, playwright, and cartoonist Saper Jafari, who was active in anti-regime protest in Iran. And we have Asma Abdi, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Exeter, whose research focuses on social reproduction, gender, and the political economy of war and sanctions. And we have joining us Maneji Moradian. She's a founding member of the Raha Iranian Feminist Collective and a member of Feminist for Jina, a global network which formed in fall 2022 to support the Women, Life, Freedom uprising in Iran. So stay tuned. Welcome, Asman Abdi, Saper Jafari, and Maneji Moradian. We don't get to have roundtable discussions enough. I just want to let the audience know we're recording this on Saturday, so we don't know what may have happened in Iran after today. But in any case, we know that the U.S. and Israel have led an imperialist attack on Iran. And today we're trying to hear from feminist and queer voices from Iran and the Iranian diaspora about how we got here, what is missing in the left analysis and the feminist analysis, to recognize that there isn't one monolithic response to the U.S.-Israeli-led attack on Iran, but that Iranians themselves have different locations for their responses on this military attack. And today I hope we can dialogue across differences, if better understand some of these failures within the left and the Iranian community, and try to figure out what is happening within different responses to those attacks. Saper, I wanted to start with you. You came here more recently than the others on this call and were active in the anti-regime protest in Iran between 2015 and 2020. You have friends who are part of the Women's Life Freedom Movement and have been in touch with them to some extent, to the extent that you can, because the internet has been shut down. When this attack first started, you showed me pictures of people in your hometown celebrating the initial killing of Khomeini. Can you help me understand that response? And I'm wondering whether you can address how activists or Iranians in Iran and here that you know see the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran generally.
Well, people were celebrating Khamenei's death. I don't know if like they were celebrating the start of war. I don't think that was like what they were celebrating at all. But they celebrated Khamenei's death because this is a man who has massacred Iranians and like ordered executions. There's a long history of him like coming up with ways to just like destroy the people of Iran. Even like if you look at very recently, 2 months ago in January, at least 30,000 Iranian protesters who went in the streets unarmed were killed by his direct order by the IRGC. So people were celebrating the death of like such a dictator. Yeah, I personally think that that's very valid, regardless of what anyone's stance on the war is.
And now we're moving into a full-scale war, and we see, you know, what leftists have been saying, that this was going to be attack on the Middle East generally and in Iran in particular. And I just wanted to talk about some of the responses, some of the fault lines in the Iranian community. I sent you a post that was put on Facebook by an Iranian professor here in the U.S., and she wrote that the Iranians who were in favor of this war on Iran are making it seem like a majority of Iranians feel that way. And she's saying she felt that this is only a select group of Iranians in Iran whose voices are amplified by the Israeli-funded Iran International and the mainstream U.S. media and do not represent the 90 millions of Iranians. And she wrote, those who say no to war, millions of Iranians, do not appear in these representations. And the Iranian diaspora, who assume themselves to speak for all Iranians in Iran, accuse anyone who says no to war of being a regime collaborator. Did you want to respond to that?
I think definitely Iran is a very diverse community. And although there's like not a lot of like people are connecting to the internet using VPNs, but it's still like a long way from knowing what they want and what they think. Definitely no one can say like all Iranians are against war or pro-war. But I think she has definitely like took on the role of a representative both now and in the past. She's framing it as Israeli propaganda that some Iranians are pro-war, which I don't think is true. I think it's very diverse from what I've personally seen. Like, I'm just one person with my own connections, but I actually, like, when I knew I was gonna do this interview, I asked my friends online, and, like, if anyone is in Iran, like, please tell me what you think. And just from, like, my own experience, most of the Iranians in Iran are actually supporting this attack, which is not to say anything, like it can't mean anything, you know, because I'm just one person. But I just think that some of the diaspora who are like elites and university professors just like are failing to recognize their own privilege and their own detachment from the reality on the ground in Iran. And again, that is not to say that all Iranians are supporting the war or anything.
I just wanted to add that this critique that I've heard seem to be part of a feminist critique over here, and some Iranians feel that Iranian feminists over here didn't support the Women Life Freedom Movement enough. And I'm thinking that perhaps that is because Iranian feminists over here have also had to criticize U.S. feminists, who they see as having used the mantle of white saviors, saying that they were saving Muslim women from the hijab in Afghanistan in particular, but using that as an excuse for U.S. intervention in Afghanistan. And I think they worry that is the rationale in Iran, too, for some, you know, Hillary Clinton-type feminists. So for these Iranian feminists and Middle Eastern feminists in the U.S. and elsewhere, the fight against Islamophobia seems very important because of the attacks by U.S. on Muslim countries. And we do see that the war is being framed as a Christian holy war by the Trump administration against Muslims in Iran. So, Saper, I know I've asked you about this too. I wonder if you could maybe explain to me how you feel about the concern about Islamophobia, which is so important over here.
I think Islamophobia is definitely a concern here. I see a lot of like Iranian scholars here who have like professions surrounding Iran matters also like kind of put that at the center of their career in a way that I think leads to a lot of erasure, because Islamophobia, I think, doesn't make sense in the context of Iran. You can't be phobic of something that actively can harm you. And you have to know that like Islam is the official religion in Iran, and you're like, you can't even convert out of it. So it's this like very different power dynamic from like the Muslim minority here and in a lot of like other countries. So I think that's like a problematic stance if it gets in the way, which it does. I think personally, it does get in the way of, you know, like amplifying Iranian voices, because they have their own stories. And like imperialism, Western imperialism is a problem in the world. And like, I think if you're living as like a person of color, as an Iranian American, or, you know, like that kind of person here, it's like a force that's actively shaping your life. But I think a lot of like scholars here don't recognize that that's not necessarily the main issue of an Iranian living in Iran. Like their most immediate, how do I say it? Like the force that is actively like destroying their lives is not I would argue, Western imperialism, although that is also a reality, but it's the Islamic Republic and the IRGC. And I also had something to add about that person's Facebook post that you read about the like no to war thing. I think some other thing that that post fails to address is that right now you have like no to war protests and there's like massive mobilizing connected to the pro-Palestine movement, which I'm not like going to address the like pro-Palestine side of that, but there's actually like people mobilizing to say no to war. And sometimes, a lot of the times, they take like the Islamic Republic flag, the like picture of Khamenei and like framing him as a martyr. And like they have IRGC symbols and take them to the, you know, like, and it leads to a very powerful erasure of Iranian voices when a lot of Iranians in the diaspora, like an imbalance of resources and power.
Hi, this is Manijay. I'm here in New York. Yeah, Sapar, thank you for everything that you laid out. I think it's all really important for people to understand. And I think where I just want to build on that is to say that I think we have to be, and we can be, and we must be, against Islamophobia and against oppression in the name of Islam that's carried out, because it's the same people targeted by both, right? Like, this shouldn't be that hard. It shouldn't be a contradiction, right? And I think this is an approach that we really desperately need in this moment, where I think that the voices of like our counterparts, like people who we might identify as fellow leftist feminist activists in Iran and in diaspora, are really insisting no to war, no to dictatorship. You know, I've seen the slogan, no war, no massacres, we will not choose between our killers. It shouldn't really be that hard to take a principled ethical stance against state violence, against war, in all of its forms, no matter who is waging it on ordinary people, no matter if it's in the name of Christianity or Islam or Zionism. We have to be against war. We have to be against militarism. We have to be against state violence. And so while I understand why many Iranians might have this initial moment of euphoria, feeling like, oh my God, the dictator's been killed, we have seen this before. You know, in Afghanistan, when the US invaded, there was initial moments of celebration that the Taliban were driven out of many parts of Afghanistan. You can understand why, right? Life under the Taliban was horrible. But very quickly, this became another kind of nightmare for Afghans, with US-backed warlords and with a 20-plus year military occupation that destroyed the country, right? Or in Iraq, when Saddam Hussein was killed, moments of celebration, right? You understand it, right? He was responsible for a lot of violence, a lot of massacres, torture. You know, people really suffered under that government. Very quickly, we realized the US sets up a sectarian government to carry out, you know, its own interests under massive amounts of violence, right? So that it's no longer safe to leave your house. And then they set up a sectarian system that leads to the development of ISIS, one of the most reactionary forces we've ever seen, that is wages war across the region and makes Iraqi people's lives miserable. It's not that hard to understand these initial moments, but I think we have to historicize them. And I'll stop talking here because I know Asma has a lot to say about the confluence of empire and domestic policies and how they bear down on people. But I think the one point I just want to make here is one of the things that is most wrenching and devastating for me in this moment is that we need to remember this is the same population that innovated a feminist revolutionary uprising, right? Just a very short time ago, what, barely 3 years ago, there was so much hope. And to be very clear, the Women Life Freedom Movement had nothing to do with imperial feminism. It had nothing to do with Islamophobia. It had nothing to do with any of that. This was about Iranian women and men from all across the country rejecting authoritarianism, rejecting second-class citizenship for women and sexual minorities and ethnic minorities. I mean, it was a tremendously inspiring movement that had nothing to do with Western discourses about hijab or Islam or anything like that. And we need to clear up those confusions because we need to figure out how to stand in solidarity with popular aspirations for democracy and a feminist future in Iran. And this war is the opposite of women life freedom. What is the opposite of women life freedom? Is war, right? War. And so we have to stop this war without reproducing any of the logics of the Islamic Republic or any illusions in the Islamic Republic as some alternative. It's not. People on the ground have been rising up over and over again for many, many years and have faced massive amounts of repression. And the fact that people would get to the point where they would support or feel like so powerless that they would almost like hope that these bombs could liberate them, that is because of the level of repression and isolation they have suffered, right? And what we need to do is build a movement in solidarity with popular self-determination so that Iranians are not abandoned and isolated, mm-hmm. and they don't have to have a fantasy that war will save them.
Thank you for both of you, Sepher and Manija, for your notes. I want to build on what both of you said, and it's very important to any kind of conversation around Iran and around like the current moment, around any discussion of solidarity and how we've got here. I think it's very important to acknowledge like a very simple act, right? This fact that the Iranian life and politics have long been under both authoritarianism and imperialism. Sepher is saying, for example, here about the Iranians being happy, and but also Manija like elaborated on that. I think, yes, it's Iranians have the right to be happy for their dictator to be dead without the imperialist powers to co-opt that emotion to impose more pain on them. At the moment, we are being sold the idea of war by the mainstream media as well, increasingly, but mostly by the right, as the war is being sold to Iranians as a solution to the dictatorship, right? In celebrating the war and the US and Israeli bombs as a solution to dictatorship, to Iranian state's imprisonments and torturing and all of that, and bullets that we saw during the January massacres, we are creating a binary as if the choice is between dictatorship and between bombardment. No, I mean, Manija's work and Sepher's lived experience just like highlights how the Iranians have always been mobilizing. What we are not short of in the country is bottom-up democratic pressures and challenging of the Iranian state. All my work has been about how the US politics of sanctions, and although they are kind of framed as very binary, as if like the choice is either between this or that, they actually reinforce each other. When you look at the history of Iran over the last 40, 50 years, we've seen more oppression over the last 20 years. We've seen, for example, I've been looking and tracing the shift in the gendered politics of the Iranian state over the last 20 years. And we see, for example, a very qualitative and real shift that it means a lot for the Iranian people's, Iranian women's lives. For example, we see a shift from an antinatalist agenda into a pronatalist agenda, and very coercive one, which is like it has included like the rise of anti-gender agendas globally. We've seen also like, you know, an increased kind of pressure on like crackdown on reproductive rights and all of that. And that is partially a response to that we see at the times of economic crisis everywhere. Right now, also in the US, right, there is like a crackdown on reproductive rights. And this is partially also a response to economic crisis. When crisis happens, there is a push to pushing women back to the household for the rise of pro-family agendas and all of that. And we can see also these shifts in Iran. We can see that, for example, the Iranian state has become more authoritarian in its like suppression of every round of protests, have created more killing and more massacre. And so we have to really contextualize this desperation, right? This massive helplessness within these longer histories of pressures on life and on politics. But what we are actually seeing the war is doing, also the reality is so very far from how it is framed, right? It is framed as it's supposed to weaken the Iranian state, right? As sanctions were supposed to be weakening the Iranian state. But they don't weaken authoritarianism in a progressive sense. They don't leave the society more empowered against the state. And the war as well, at the moment, if you follow the patterns of destruction and what the US and Israeli governments are and their bombs are targeting in Iran, like the war has already killed 1,000 people, including 200 children. On the first day, they attacked an elementary school, killing 200 girl children. And they've been attacking life-sustaining infrastructure. They've been attacking hospitals, schools, homes, and all of this. And also they have been, interestingly, attacking, like, I don't know, like oppositional figures inside the country. On the first day, as they attacked the supreme leader's office, they also attacked, for example, one of the oppositional figures inside the country, Mir Hossein Mousavi's house. Mir Hossein Mousavi, for example, was one of the figures during the massacre that called on the supreme leader to step down and called on referendum. And they are like, you know, they are also eliminating, they're trying to eliminate. So this is a war, not against the Iranian state, but against life and politics in Iran. This kind of targeting the possibilities for life, for any futurities, and for any forms of homegrown governance.
Sapere, did you want to respond?
Sure, I can just pick up some things from what was said. First of all, I just want to mention that Mir Hossein Mousavi also like ordered executions and is by all means and purposes a terrorist figure. And I don't personally think there is any reform possible in like a regime that is. And this is like also something that I heard my friends in Iran mention more than one time. How a lot of Iranians are seeing it, I think, is that this is a regime that has occupied Iran for 47 years and has been actively calling for war. I don't consider this war an unprovoked war. And I think like one of the main reasons people were like protesting so much was because of like the really bad international relations that the regime had. And they are also very much responsible, if not as responsible, for the creation of this war. So is anyone who has like in any way made it possible for them to stay in power for 47 years, which I would also like consider reformists. And I think like a lot of people in Iran are in the past at least 6 or 7 years is like very much against the idea of reformism and like reformist figures. I completely understand that like you can't expect a war to like make things better. And I don't think everyone is just like hoping that this war will liberate them. But also I think in the mind of some Iranians, at least, it is like an ongoing war. Like when you have 30,000 people die in 2 days, that is not war, I think, because it was literally like war weapons were used to do mass killings. And so I also think that because there has been Iranians who have been calling for intervention, for like R2P, for example, and like sanctions even, I think to say that it's definitely a fantasy and like these are oppressed people. And so if they have this fantasy of liberation, they are delusional. That is to like speak over them, because they may not know everything, but I think they definitely know more than anyone who hasn't spent a lot of time living in Iran in the past decade. They know more about their own circumstances, even if that doesn't make them right. And the other thing that I was going to say is that I understand the logic of like comparing this to like other invasions or like other wars that have happened in the past. But I think to say that this is going to end exactly as Iraq did or Afghanistan did, I think there is some like bit of racism there, because these are all very different countries. And I can't imagine anyone like comparing two European countries, like neighboring European countries, in the same way, for example. So I don't understand why people just assume that this is going to go exactly as the Iraq war goes. Like, it could definitely, like, who am I to say? But I just like want to make sure that no one like speaks over Iranians who literally, like some of them, think that this is the only way forward, because they have literally done everything under the sky to get rid of the regime. I'm sure like if the regime stays in place, there's going to be thousands more who will die because of this regime. I think to expect people to do it empty-handed, with like in front of IRGC, who is like literally using war weapons, that's also in a different way of wanting war, a different kind of war to continue, if that makes sense.
So can I clarify? Because I'm not saying that what's
Oh,
going to
just say
happen.
your name so
Sorry, this
everybody.
is Manijay. Yeah, just to be clear, my point was not that what's going to happen in Iran is predicted and exactly like what happened in Afghanistan or Iraq. They are very different places. My point was not to predict the future and say it's going to be exactly that. My point was to say that we've seen before the contradictions of war when dictatorships who have in one way or another stood up to the US, right, but have been brutalizing their own people when those are overthrown outside, right, by foreign powers who don't share the same interests as the people who've been suffering under those dictatorships, right? We have historical examples. History doesn't repeat itself. I mean, we've never been in this war in this moment before. So I don't think it's racist to draw on historical examples to say, well, what can we learn from these, right? We're not, it's not going to predict the future because every situation is different and the dynamics of every society are different. Saddam Hussein's government was much, much weaker, for example, than the Iranian state, which is still in power, right? So my point is to argue that we have to take a consistent position against war, that we have to be against war, whether it's waged by the Islamic Republic against its own people, which has been going on, or whether it's coming from Israel and the US. That war is, as Asma said, is against politics. It's against subjectivity. And it's not the case that we sit here in diaspora and are expecting Iranian people, well, you go liberate yourselves. I think what we need to do is build real solidarity. We need to build international solidarity movements against war and against dictatorship. Our job here is not just to say hands off Iran and ignore what the Islamic Republic has been doing. That to me, that's not solidarity.
Can I clarify? I just didn't mean that Manisha said that. I meant like the discourse of like being like, this is another Iraq. And that's like, I think that is the racism, not what Manisha said. Sorry if I didn't.
But like, there's no example where imperialist war liberates people. Like, it's just not what they're doing. They have
But
a different
I think there
policy
are
than that.
examples of like foreign intervention that has helped, which doesn't mean that it's gonna this time.
We need to get into unpacking those examples, right? And really looking
Exactly.
at those dynamics.
First of all, I think we have to really differentiate between what Iranians say inside Iran and what the Zionist kind of imperialist war machinery is pushing for, because this is for me very different. I mean, there is the right discourse that is disgusting, that is dehumanizing Iranians, like Netanyahu is calling Iranians Amalek, for example. These are disgusting. Like, but also the Iranians whose my parents are living there, who I've lived with under the oppression of the Iranian state myself, right? My research has involved field works, talking to people, and I've always been aware of so many different kind of viewpoints and generational viewpoints amongst Iranians. And I completely agree with the point that Sepher is making here in terms of the last 10 years in Iran, because I think the last 10 years in Iran is particularly the moment. I mean, if you look at, for example, the macro indicator shifts in Iran, like the last 10 years has been devastating. When I was, for example, doing field work with Iranians, they remember that 10 years through the prices of like, you know, pizza. Like when I, for example, sometimes I would say, when did you get married? They would tell me, like, do you remember when pizza was this price? But these are really linked to economic sanctions. And so I personally, as someone who's coming from a lower middle class family, I have no reconciliation with the politics of sanctions from personally. But also I acknowledge that there is like, after I left Iran, you know, there's been like maybe a shift in like increased oppression and all of that. And I totally acknowledge that. But when we talk about the Iranians, I mean, it's really important to also, I mean, for everyone, I guess, very to acknowledge that so many also that I also have been in touch with them. Right now, there are accounts coming out of social media from Iranian activists that they are like a letter came out by Malju, for example, who is an Iranian economist who was actually arrested a few months ago. He wrote a letter against like the bombs. So this is there is a very diversity of views. I mean, in terms of your point, Sepher, about like reformists, when I mentioned Mir Hossein Mousavi, I'm not calling for a reformist politics. I know he stands for reformism, but this is not about this is that about the fact that the Israelis are they also attacked Evin prison because they want to attack the any politics that homegrown politics. Yes, Mir Hossein Mousavi might have done like all of those stuff, but this is an indigenous form. This comes from No one is set in history. People have changed. Mir Hossein Mousavi have changed his views. I'm not defending Mir Hossein Mousavi, but I'm just arguing for giving a chance to the type of politics that has grown within Iran.
I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in and especially thank those of you who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin.
If you're just tuning in, we are talking to three feminist Iranian and Iranian-American scholars and activists about what an Iranian feminist response to the attack against Iran should be. I am joined by Manajeh Maradia, Asma Abdi, and Sapar Jafari. Let's go back to that interview now. Can I just say something? I get the impression some people, including Sapar, feel that not enough feminists, Iranian feminists over here, supported the Women Life Freedom movement sufficiently, and that they were more concerned about Islamophobia. That's one. Two, I think, Asma, you have said that sanctions were a major force, but that also the neoliberal patriarchal state's policies in Iran were foreclosed spaces for resistance. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because I think as leftists, we're all fully aware that the U.S. is over there for oil. They couldn't care less about the Iranians, that they are not there to liberate the Iranians, that they're there for U.S. interests. And if the Iranians somehow miraculously end up with a leader Trump picks that is going to be less bad than Khomeini, it'll be a miracle. And we have to acknowledge that the Islamic Revolution originally made the economy much better than the Shah, who had enormous illiteracy and inequality. So I think I would like to hear a little bit, and then we'll go back to you, Sapar, a little bit from you, Asma, about how you see the Iranian state, the Islamic state, as having foreclosed spaces for resistance and creating more neoliberal patriarchal policies in the last 10 years and maybe the last 20 years that were part of what happened with the sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, thank you for the question. I think it's a very important question. And when we think about the foreclosure of political possibilities, I think, in Iran, I would like to think about it within a wider history, but also in specifically in the moment of January massacre, which I think like that was like a massive moment of the production of a political impasse, a stuckness, I would say. So I guess, first of all, I think these like spaces for resistance we've seen that gradually has been kind of being foreclosed in Iran. So the time that, for example, Manijeh mentioned that during the reform era, we saw the rise of many, at the beginning of the revolution, we see like an increase in literacy policies, because the 1979 revolution relied upon also some kind of leftist aspirations of like to provide the welfare, and the Iranian state has started. And then there is a lot of literature talking about how the eight-year war actually pushed the Iranian state to provision of more welfare, because the participation in war was like so much, like provision of welfare was promised by participation to war. So for example, if you were like, I don't know, someone in a rural area that wanted to go to the Iran-Iraq, I'm talking about the Iran-Iraq war, which happened from 1980 to 1988. Like if you were like from a village or something, if you participated in war, you could just go into the state and say, okay, I participated in the war, like I lost a son, you have to like build a school here, you have to build, you know. So we see an expansion of kind of welfare, social welfare, kind of an infrastructure into this rural area. And a very revolutionary, I think, like something that had a very revolutionary effect was at the end of the 80s, we had a shift to an antinatalist family planning program. So during that time, there was like family planning program that promoted taking contraceptions and all of that. And Iran is often in literature is an example of a country that in a very short amount of time, actually in a decade, the fertility rate, for example, in the country dropped from 6 children per woman to 1.8. It's such a shift can have a lot of impact in women's lives, right? So part of the fact that actually Iranian women are also so much politically active and their political agencies is also because of these shifts, because of the increased literacy rates. And this is not the work of the Iranian state, right? This is also the enthusiasm from a lot of women to participate in all of that. But like we see a gradual shift to neoliberal policies after, you know, at the beginning of the 90s, there was always like a lot of like labor strikes against them. There was a lot of resistance against these policies of like subsidy reduction and all of that. And we see an acceleration of shift to these neoliberal policies, in particular in the last decade. We see more and more subsidy reductions and privatization, for example, all of this has been promoted. And a lot of times, actually, the Iranian state many times kind of uses sanctions as an excuse to justify austerity. So we see like these discourses really help each other, like saying, okay, I have budget deficiencies and all of that. And sanctions also have given rise to some sort of economy in Iran that in Iranian literature, Iranian economists refer to as trusty economy. Literally, that means like corruption in a way, because you have to sell oil through the black market. And then that means that really reshaped the structures of political economy. So there are like, you know, you need to have these mediators through which you sell oil. And then often actually when January massacre happened, at the beginning, we saw that the protest was initiated by a budget deficiency that brought out a lot of like people in the bazaar, like the bazaar, which is like the traditional kind of market, the traditional kind of capital owners in Iran. Initially, they started the protests. And this was like a response to all of this. And at the time, the response of the Iranian state was like harsher. Like, and then following that, as we saw the protests got widespread, so many, I mean, there's lots of like grievances, economic, political, and all of that for people to come into the street. And yeah, I mean, at that moment, the massacre in particular, and this increased oppression, I think these frameworks that you can't really disentangle them that well. I mean, the massive killing, the mass killing at that time, and also the fact that, you know, the protests were already going on. People were already in the streets. And at the time, Reza Pahlavi, when protests were already was going on, came out and put a statement and called on people to come to the streets. People were already out. People didn't come out because of Reza Pahlavi. Many people, of course, they called for him. And again, that is like really, but...
Well, Asma, can I ask you, just before you go on, given that the sanctions had so much effect on Iran, do you think that the Iranian regime could have responded less patriarchally or less neoliberally or less authoritarian in a way that would have avoided these demonstrations and still maintained their power, but maybe they could have transformed? Are you saying that sanctions basically determined their response and they didn't have another response because of the system? Could there have been an alternative for the regime?
I mean, you can't remove the agency of the Iranian state, right? The state, well, we generally see across various empirical cases, if you look, like even the 2008 financial crisis that happened globally, if you look at the literature around that, oftentimes the literature talks about the fact that crises can create, for example, patriarchal responses, right? But the patriarchal policies that we see over the last decade, that includes, for example, a very coercive and very, really brutal crackdown on reproductive rights, for example. No, these are political choices, right? Exactly as this war is a political choice, you know, that the US, I know we can't really remove the agency of those ones who commit this type of things.
I think sometimes on the left, though, there does seem to be this collapsing of and this rhetoric that this is all because of U.S. destabilization of Iran, overthrow of the elected government decades ago, and the desire for oil. Now, I guess I'm wondering, did Iran have another choice besides becoming more brutal to the sanctions?
So in terms of Iran's foreign policy and sanctions, I mean, Iran did everything to remove sanctions, I think. And in that sense, it didn't have much agency. Because every time, like from 2012, we saw that Iran has been, in general, was conforming with, like, for example, the rules of international law, with the fact that, like, with international atomic energy organizations, for example, and in 2015, there was like a nuclear deal. There was actually a very historical deal. At the time, even people came out to the streets, they celebrated the conclusion of the deal. In 2 years, like the US withdrew from that deal, and that was like with no reason. And then the Iran has been constantly trying to negotiate with the US. We saw that in the 12-day war, Iran was in negotiation that like the war happened. And this round also again, internationally, the Iranian state, I don't know how much choice it had because it tried to. But in terms of domestic politics, Iranian state, yes, could have. You can't really remove the Iranian state's agency because there's been a lot of Iranian economists inside the countries that they've argued against this politics of like privatization. You know, if some sort of like kind of distributive policies were still in place, when we think about the effects of sanctions has overall shrank the Iranian economy. So when you look at, for example, GDP per capita from 2012 until 2020, literally, the Iranian economy has become one-third. So GDP per capita has dropped from around $8,000 to something around $3,000. That means every Iranian's share of economy, if the economy were supposed to be distributed with the same proportions as before, has become one-third. But what makes it even worse is that within the Iranian political economy, has been restructured in ways that has increased inequalities and have really pushed the burdens of sanctions into those in the lower, like very classed and very gendered, right? It is classed because there's been a lot of like actually another colleague who's worked on the labor movements and she's not here today, like Ida Niku, she's written on lots about like this like coercive labor policies and labor, you know, how the effects of like no liberalization has meant the privatization of the state's assets while cracking down on labor, right? And pushing the effects of sanctions onto the labor. And on top of that, we see also these gendered policies. That is, for me, it's been a way for the Iranian state to extract labor, like unpaid labor, domestic labor from women, right?
I have seen for 50 years how destabilizing the U.S. is when they do imperialism, that they, when you destroy the economy, you almost always going to end up with some kind of authoritarian government, because it's very hard when when sanctions and other things destroy the economy, it makes it hard to have a democracy. However, I completely agree that the form of authoritarianism or the reaction to that is something that's specific to each country. Okay, go ahead, Sapir, you had your hand up.
Oh, I just had something to say about, you mentioned the economic like flourishing a bit after the revolution. And I just wanted to say that that's like, that era is the most brutal, has had one of the most brutal like crackdown and like number of executions, mm-hmm. like thousands of people were executed during that time. And I personally know of people who have had like parents in prison at that time. So the human rights violation have started from day one before like any sanctions were in place.
Okay, Asma, then we'll go to Manish.
All my scholarship is against de-exceptionalizing Iran. I think it's very orientalist to say Iran is an exceptional case. You know, a state is a highly patriarchal, gendered kind of framework everywhere, and everywhere is also different. I don't also want to say that everywhere is the same. I mean, Iran is not the only sanctioned country. There has been like sanctions been a tool, it's been used over the last century on many countries, and when you look at it, it always creates authoritarianism. But of course, the Iranian state has been authoritarian. I understand myself as a feminist Marxist, I know that the Iranian state killed many Marxist people in prisons during, and this is not to erase that history, if that is what you mean. This is to say that also within the Iranian state structures, we've had moments that it was different. If you just look at the numbers, like numbers on a graph, Khatami was different for so many Iranian women. Many women, they have a formal employment is from that era because the formal employment for women kind of stopped later that much. And I think the everyday life of women matters, basically, because all of this has like a really a qualitative impact. It makes a lot of difference if you have access to contraception or you don't have access to contraception. It makes a lot of difference for Iranian women, for any woman in the world, as a matter of fact. If you go to a village in your, and that was part of the, for example, health clinics in many villages in Iran, that they provided free information around reproductive rights. We see, like, for example, a massive drop in teenagers' pregnancies in the post-revolutionary era and all of that. As much as I hate the, you know, the glorification of the Iranian state, I also hate to say that it's always been the same. I don't think we've always been dealing with the same state, because the Iranian state wasn't always a neoliberal state, for example. It wasn't always, like, economic policies has shifted and all of that.
Just want to get to Manijay.
Yeah, look, as leftists, we have to have a critique of capitalism and the nation state, right? As well as imperialism. Like, I think that it's right that we need to engage with the specificity of Iran, but we need to acknowledge that the Iranian state has pursued a ruthless policy of capital accumulation at the expense of the vast majority of people. They have willingly adopted many of the same policies that the left criticizes when the IMF imposes it on other countries, industrial adjustments, privatization, subsidy cuts. The Iranian state has willingly done these things, right? In fact, it's been very much in line with the patterns of capital accumulation globally, right? And we see that everywhere in the world, that kind of voracious, extractive capitalist accumulation leads to authoritarianism. We see the rise of right-wing authoritarian movements globally, right? This is part of the crisis of this moment. And I just implore listeners to think about Iran as connected to the rest of the world, right? That the same way we had mass movements in Latin America, mass feminist strikes, mass movements of workers against neoliberal policies and against authoritarian states, we have these same dynamics inside of Iranian society. And yes, the Iranian state has agency. I mean, every time people rose up, they could have decided to grant structural change. They could have conceded. They could have given reforms. In the 2009 elections, what were people calling for? Count the votes. That was the demand. Where is my vote? Count our votes. It was not a revolutionary movement. At the time, those of us who were against the regime, we were a tiny minority, and everyone said, you're out of touch. Iranians don't want a revolution. They want reform. So, okay, all right. Democracy, yes, we support that, you know. But what did the state do? They put the opposition leaders under house arrest, where they remain to this day, and unleashed massive violence against people who were just saying, we want our votes counted, right? And so from there, we have the end of the reformist era, and Iranians have been on a journey. They've been on a journey of strikes, of protests, of struggle in many, many forms. And for me, the highlight of all of it was, I think the Women Life Freedom Movement innovated new political idioms, innovated new concepts of what feminism and revolution and a transformation of social relations and daily life from the bottom up, what that could look like. And the Iranian state, they could have stopped enforcing mandatory hijab or removed that law completely. They did not. They imposed even harsher policies that if you're caught driving without hijab, we'll take your car away, that you can't access your bank account if you're not wearing hijab, not to mention the amounts of violence and shooting people in the eye and arresting people and torturing. I mean, they didn't have to do that.
You wrote about how in your article, Iran and the U.S. anti-war movement, what's missing from the left's analysis? I think we're all coming from a more feminist analysis. What's missing from the left's analysis of Iran for you?
A thoroughgoing critique of the Islamic Republic as a patriarchal, authoritarian, capitalist state. We should have no illusions. Just because the Islamic Republic uses anti-American, anti-Israel rhetoric, right? If anti-imperialism and anti-Zionism are completely hollowed out and have no relationship to justice or freedom or equality or ending violence, what is the meaning? It is little more than state propaganda, which justifies Iran's foreign policy in the region, right? Iran intervenes in many other countries, not for democracy, but to keep its own power base, right? And so if you talk to feminists in Iraq, for example, I don't want to speak for all feminists in Iraq, but the feminists, the Iraqi feminist colleagues that I have, you know, they will point out that Iran is an occupying power in Iraq. It is an obstacle in the path of Iraqi freedom movements and feminist movements, because Iran is supporting these armed militias that are going around assassinating people and controlling the country. That's not democracy. So again, and it's not anti-imperialism, right? So I think the left has to stop having some affective and political attachment to the Islamic Republic. We have to recognize that Iranian people have more than one source of oppression. And I have this concept, intersectional anti-imperialism. Maybe it's too academic and jargony to be useful to most people, but it draws on Black feminist and women of color feminist thinking about the fact that we can't choose between fighting racism and fighting sexism, right? For example, we have to fight both because they're impacting the same bodies and lives and futures, and because they work hand in hand. It's similar if we think about imperialism and the authoritarian Islamist state in Iran. They are both intersecting and overlapping on the bodies and lives and economic futures of ordinary people in Iran. You know, there's more than one source of oppression. There's more than one enemy of working class and feminist movements in Iran. And we have to have a consistent position against all forms of oppression.
And Manijay, I think you're also calling for a feminist analysis, because I think too that that's missing, and this wouldn't be overseen if there was a feminist analysis. And we talk about Iraq, Yanar Mohammed, an Iraqi feminist, was just murdered in Iraq on March 2nd, and one of our hosts, Margot Okazar-Ray, is going to be replaying an interview with her later this month. Could you both explain how a feminist analysis of Iran is important?
Absolutely. So feminists in what was once called the Third World, now we call the Global South, have long had a critique of the post-colonial nation state, right? The post-colonial nation state did not deliver on its promises. The post-colonial nation state reproduced class inequality and various forms of patriarchy and gendered governance, like Asma was talking about. Every government does this. It's not unique to Iran. Every government has a policy around access to contraception, pronatalist or not, how women can access the workforce, what kind of citizenship rights and status is available to women, right? All governments regulate gender. They regulate reproduction. They regulate the family. This is about perpetuating a certain model of what the nation state, how it will continue, and what the ideal citizen subject should be, right? And all of that burden is placed on women. The state intervenes and regulates the most intimate spheres of our life, right? There's not really a separation between the public and the domestic, or the personal and the political. These are all spheres in which the state intervenes, using whatever ideological perspective it has to justify what it's doing. So a feminist anti-imperialist politics, a feminist politics has to be critical of the patriarchal nation state, and it has to be critical of the idea that all we need to do is sort of like maybe just change this or that, you know, person at the top of the society. No, I think a feminist politics means we need to transform social relations, economic relations, and the whole way that we reproduce life. And I think really that's what the Women, Life, Freedom has to offer the world, is really a critique of the state as a colonial formation. Right, that nation states come out of the experience of colonization, and decolonization did not overcome that form. It in fact inhabited it, and it inhabited it in an unequal global terrain in which countries like Iran have been severely isolated and their economies massively distorted by imperial pressure, no doubt, no doubt. But the project itself is flawed. I think what we need to do is really learn from the Women, Life, Freedom movement and from other revolutionary feminist movements. I mentioned the mass strikes in Latin America because I think that's another real high point where we have to understand that everything is a feminist issue. The ecological crisis is a feminist issue. The economic crisis is a feminist issue. Do we organize our societies around extraction and domination and inequality, or do we organize them around the conditions in which life of all kinds can thrive, right? And people can realize their potential and live on their own terms, right? This is really a global struggle. And Iran, in many ways, Iranian movements have sometimes been at the leading edge of fighting for an alternative, of fighting for a different future. And as the bombs are falling and as the regime is threatening to shoot anyone on site who dares to protest, right, as Iranians are caught these horrible forms of mass violence, let's not forget that that same population has also produced ideas and idioms of struggle and movements that have so much to teach us. I mean, we need our own Women, Life, Freedom movement right here. Iranians are in tremendous danger, tremendous, tremendous danger. And we have to do everything we can here to stop this war and build real international solidarity to support, you know, their struggles for self-determination on their own terms.
Okay, thank you. And Sapere, I'm going to give you the last word.
Just going to give like a prompt. Let's imagine we stop this war and like the day after, what is that solidarity going to look like? What are we going to do for the thousands of or like millions of people in prison right now waiting to be executed? What are we going to do for their families? What's going to happen to the people of Iran? I think only people would only like consent to war if they already believe they live in war.
I think that this has been a good discussion. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you. Good to meet you all.
And you have been listening to an interview with Manajeh Mouradian, Asma Abdi, and Sapere Jafari, talking about an Iranian and Iranian-American feminist perspective on Iran. You can get more information about them or listen to the show again by going to KPFA Radio's Women's Magazine archive on KPFA's website. And that's it for today's show. I've been your host today, Lisa Detmer. Thanks for joining us. Stay strong, stay in the streets, and stay safe.
For dancing in the alleys and the streets, for the thrill and the fear of getting caught kissing, for my sister, my brother, and unity, for all the times we tried to change their minds and stale beliefs, for the loss of pride, for poverty, for the dream of just a normal life for you and me, for all the children who are starving for a loaf of bread, for the greed of politics and all the lies they spread, for all the mass polluted air we breathe, for all the litter in the streets and all the dying trees, for all the animals who suffer from elimination, for all the cats and dogs who love us without no conditions, for all the tears that seem to never end, for all the images that keep on turning in our heads, for a simple smile to last a little while, for the future generations fighting for their time, for empty promises of heaven in the afterlife, for all the imprisonment of beautiful minds, for all the babies who were born and for the ones who died, for all the times you told the truth and all the times you lied, for all the speeches that we heard about.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us oldschoolstyle at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, too. Today's intro music was by Maya Jane Coles. Thanks for listening.
KPFK 90.7 FM honors the voices that refuse to be silenced. In celebration of Women's History Month, we're opening the vaults. Join us every Monday in the month of March from 1 to 2 p.m. as we dive deep into the Pacifica Radio archives. From the radical grassroots organizers of the 60s, To the poets and visionaries who reshaped our culture, we're bringing you the authentic sounds of women making history. These are the recordings that captured a movement uncensored, unfiltered, and uniquely KPFK. That's Mondays at 1 p.m. Honor the past, inspire the future. KPFK 90.7 FM, radio powered by the people.
Support comes from the Alex Theater, presenting the Ravi Shankar Ensemble on March 31st at 8 p.m. Curated by Anushka and Sukanya Shankar, this debut U.S. tour celebrates the legendary Ravi Shankar's music with rare archival visuals and live performance featuring sitar, tabla, and traditional Indian classical instruments. This will be a very special evening honoring Ravi Shankar's enduring legacy. More information and tickets available at itsmyseat.com and kpfk.org.